Welcome. You're listening to the Mac Observer's Background Mode. This is your host, John Martellaro. And this week, my guest is Jackie Cheng, editor-in-chief of The Wirecutter. Jackie, good afternoon.
Good afternoon to you.
Thank you very much for being on the show. Been looking forward to this for a while.
Yeah, I've been listening to your stuff on and off for a long time, and so I'm excited to be here.
Well, thank you for being on the show. I want to ask you about all things Wirecutter and before that Ars Technica, where I first got to know you. I think I was one of the first people to follow you on Twitter a long, long time ago.
Oh, wow.
But first, I want to ask you about what we were talking about before the show. You started your early career as a programmer. Tell us about that.
Yeah. My real backstory is not a lot different from a lot of nerdy people that we probably all know. I was one of those kids who was really into computers in the 80s and the 90s. And then, you know, when the internet started becoming a thing, I was one of those people who was always coming up with new mischievous scripts and things to basically punk other people. Nowadays, you'd probably get prosecuted for that stuff.
The 80s, that must have been an Apple II.
Yeah, well, I probably had an Apple II when I was in school. And then my mother, who is also actually kind of a nerd herself in her own way, she just loved buying like new technology. And so she got the new Mac SE when it first came out. And then that was my first computer at home. And I was obviously very excited about that. And so, when I went to college, eventually I went into Purdue University, which is kind of it's an engineering school.
Oh, and Purdue. Oh, cool. I went to Indiana University right next door.
Oh, how fun. Hoosiers.
Yep.
I went there and I did not, at that time, it was the late 90s and they had just launched this new school at Purdue. It was called the School of Technology, which I didn't, at the time I didn't really know anything about it. I just kind of thought it sounded interesting. So I enrolled there. I originally started out in like kind of systems. I was a sort of a networking kind of person. And then I sort of switched into...
Were you a Unix geek?
Sort of. I was doing a lot of like database stuff and networking in general. That it was sort of like the core curriculum for technology people at the time. I was really getting into networking technologies. At the time, this is like really base wireless stuff and then Ethernet and that kind of thing. But then I sort of switched gears a little bit and I went into, I can't even remember what they called my major because it was something very strange and sort of abstract. But ultimately, it was a very practical approach to programming. So I would say that, the CS students were kind of over in the CS building doing their theory stuff. And we were doing a lot of, in a way, it was kind of trade-like. We were doing a lot of very like real world sort of programming problems. A lot of our professors were actually brought in from like companies and stuff. So we didn't have a lot of tenure track professors. We had people who had come from Microsoft or come from Sun Microsystems to teach us. And so I sort of got that sort of programming training. And after school,
what was your specialty in languages?
Oh, man. Well, my specialty, I guess you could say, not that this is anything to brag about now. I was really into C# and C++. So
great language, C++.
Yeah. And that's kind of what I went into right out of school. I went into sort of like back-end web stuff. So I did a lot of, I kind of came back to databases a little bit, but I was programming, the parts that sort of connect databases with everything else. And I did that for several years out of school. I sort of bounced between a couple of jobs and, eventually I sort of transitioned away from that, but that's what I was doing at the time.
Was it easy for you to find a job with that kind of technical background?
Yeah, actually, it's really strange. I have to admit, I did not really expect this, but the demand for C# people was very high. And I find still today, actually, it's still kind of high. I still get recruiters contacting me about C#, jobs, even though I haven't really done that stuff in probably 10 years at this point.
My wife still gets recruiter calls about Java, trying to rake her into downtown Denver and do technical work.
Yeah, in a lot of ways, it's a little terrifying to know that everyone still has these old systems that I guess, you know, you need that stuff updated, I suppose. But yeah, you know, I think even back then, I was fresh out of school. I had done, you know, I was programming and stuff like as side jobs while I was in school, but I had never had a real job. So I didn't really have experience.
Was this in Indiana? Because Indiana is kind of was a low-tech state back then.
Yeah, no, I had started out obviously kind of taking sort of side jobs and summer jobs in Indiana, but then after school I moved to Cincinnati. So,
yes.
You know, that was a interesting place. You know, it's a great city down there. It's a small city, but I didn't have a problem finding jobs.
Awesome. Awesome. So then you ended up in, I think, Chicago, right?
Yeah, I'm originally from Chicago, so in some ways it's sort of predictable, I guess. But I eventually quit my second job out of school, which was a development job, and my husband Clint Ecker, or he wasn't my husband then, but he is now. He also wanted a change, and so we just decided we were going to go to Chicago. And at that time, I had quit my job, and then I was sort of feeling out what was coming next.
Did you go to Chicago without an offer? Just sort of like, let's move there and see what happens.
Oh yeah, yeah, I did.
That's pretty amazing. Risky, scary.
Yeah, you know, I have no idea why I did not see that as a huge risk at the time. at the time, I was just kind of into it. I was like, yeah, let's go.
You're young. You can do anything.
Yeah. But that was also when I was sort of transitioning into working for ours. So I sort of knew that might have been coming up. And, you know, it was not locked down, certainly. But I sort of felt positive about it. So I was okay with making that move.
Did ours have an office in Chicago you could go to? Or did you still work out of a home office?
No, ours did not have an office. Actually, ours technically did not have an office until like last year. At the time, though, there were a lot of staffers who, we didn't actually have staff at the time, but people who were heavy contributors, such as myself, there were a few of those people in the Chicago area. So I kind of was, I was simultaneously moving to be near family and stuff, but also I knew that I could be near all these other smart people who I'd been sort of working with over the internet for a while.
Yeah, I really like the authors at Ars Technica. John Brodkin is one, and there's some others who write about security.
Yeah, Dan Gooden over there,
right.
Joe Mullen, Nate Anderson, all these people are you know, brilliant, smart, amazing people. So
IPv6 geek stuff.
Yeah, Ilyitz, he loves IPv6, and I'm so happy to say that I hired him over there. So yeah, you know, there's a lot going on there still, and you know, I still read their stuff. So it's a great place.
How long were you there?
So when I moved to Chicago around 2006, and then in early 2007, that was when ours began actually hiring people as real employees. And so I was hired in early 2007, and I was there until 2013. So
that's a good stint.
Yeah, something like 7 or 8 years, and a couple years before that as a freelancer.
So what was your specialty when you were writing for ours? Did you have one that you focused on?
Most people know my work mostly under sort of the Apple umbrella. By the time I left, I was senior Apple editor, so I did a lot of Apple coverage. But, you know, before then, I did a lot of like internet law coverage as well, in addition to Apple and gadgets and stuff. So I would say that was the most interesting thing to me, was covering, you know, even in 2007 and 2008, internet law and internet culture in general was still really kind of developing, and people were feeling it out. And for me, that was just really, really intellectually stimulating. And so even still now, you know, I read up on everything that's happening all the time, and I give my unqualified opinion on all the developments. So that was really fun for me. But ultimately, I was an Apple person, and at the time, they needed someone who was strong in writing that stuff, who also wasn't sort of drinking the Kool-Aid.
Well, if you're writing about it, you have to have all that stuff. That's what I tell my wife. You know, I got to have an iPhone if I'm going to write about it. I got to have an iPad Pro if I'm going to write about it. You know? Is that what you did?
I think that and I was always kind of a life, you know, again, actually going back to my mother, you know, she was always buying that stuff when I was a kid and she was kind of a Mac person. And so, you know, admittedly that sort of influenced me and I was always a Mac person and an Apple person.
I wanted to ask you about that. I'm glad you returned to the idea of your mother because I've been interviewing some professional women who are, advocating STEM and women in science. I interviewed a university professor last week who's strong on that. And one of the influences that she pointed out that was strong was her parents. Her parents were very technical professors, I think. And it seems to be a recurring theme that when people I interview had really strong technical parents, maybe not necessarily professors or anything, but just, you know, had computers around the house and introduced mm-hmm. them to Apple IIs and programming, that was a strong influence on their life.
Yeah. And I mean, to be fair, my parents are, I suppose you could argue that they're in STEM. They both became dentists, but you know, they're not technical people in that they're not really computery people. I would say, though, that my mother, especially since she was very science minded, you know, the science minded kind of person who would go into dentistry. And she also really, you know, in a weird way, it was very practical for her. She needed that stuff to run her business. You know, she needed to have a computer to be able to do payroll on the computer instead of by hand and that kind of stuff. So in a way, she was just into that because she needed it. And then I just sort of reaped the benefits because technology was just around all the time.
Did you have things like Byte and Popular Science laying around the living room on the coffee table, stuff like
that? Oh, yeah. I mean, having parents for dentists for parents means that you get like every magazine on Earth. They get so many subscriptions and then they just brought them home. So, yeah, I certainly read pretty much everything that came in magazine form. And that's actually also why I got into like Mac media. I really was into Macworld and Mac User Magazine and Mac Addict. And those were all things that my parents got at their office. And I just always took from them.
Backtracking a little bit, what was life like at Purdue with you as a woman in programming? Were you just shoulder to shoulder with all the guys, you know, messing with the machines and doing networking? Or did you sense any kind of resistance, to put it politely?
It's a little hard to describe. I would say that at that time, I was already very used to being probably the only woman in the class, or like one of the only ones. I was very used to being that person. So in a lot of ways, I kind of didn't notice it as much because it was so sort of embedded in my brain. I think a lot of my classmates were great. I had good working relationships with my classmates. It was actually the professors and teachers and TAs and stuff that I struggled with the most. I was just tweeting about this the other day, but I had a not insignificant number of professors who hit on me in class openly in front of like 200 people. That happened multiple times. I had several professors who were trying to, you know, set up weird meetings alone at strange places.
You were married at this time, right?
Oh, no.
Oh, okay. My mistake. Sorry.
Yeah, no. I had a lot of that stuff, actually. And professors, I wouldn't say that they didn't take me seriously, though. I would say that, if anything, I was just dealing with a lot of harassment from them. But the ones that were not doing that, I felt like they were perfectly great. I had some really good professors who recognized that I was also a very ambitious student, and I was kind of one of those annoying people who was always turning in projects early and calling out other, you know, students for not doing things. So I was kind of that person, and professors generally like that kind of person. So it went over well for me at the time.
Two questions now. Did you have any particularly effective techniques against these professors who were harassing you? And did you, on the other hand, did you have some professors who were your mentors and sought specifically to help you succeed?
You know, I guess my techniques for the harassment was mostly just to avoid as much as possible. So in that respect, it may have hurt me for those specific classes because I would often, you know, sit in as far back as I possibly could in the room or never go to meetings with them. You know, I can't remember the exact specifics, but I'm sure that probably I did not maybe absorb as much information as I probably should have or might have normally in a normal scenario. As far as mentors go, I don't know that anyone specifically worked with me super closely, but I did have several professors who really, like I said, you know, they kind of appreciated that I was really pushing really hard. And I had at least one professor. His name is Ron Glatzbach. Maybe he's listening. He always encouraged me to take everything a step further, especially since I was always finishing projects early. And so he would come back to me and say, okay, you have a whole week left while everyone else is behind. Why don't you, you know, see what else you can do to step this up and awesome. Really make them feel the burn, you know?
Nice.
And so that was really good for me. I really appreciated him encouraging me to push further on a lot of stuff.
Cool. Thank you for sharing that with us. Well, you know what? We have to take a short break right now. This is like a good place to do that. And when we return, I want to ask you about Wirecutter and your thoughts on Apple and a few other things. But right now, we've got to take a short commercial break. Folks, we'll be right back in 60 seconds. Stay with us.
Hello there, all you fabulous background mode listeners. I'm Kelly Gamont with the Mac Observer, and I just want to say a few words about how you can support all the things we do. If you're thinking about buying something from Apple, Amazon, or Mac Mall, just go to the Mac Observer's homepage where we have a section called Support TMO. Or you can just enter macobserver.com/Apple Store, all one word, and that will take you to our special page for Apple and our other affiliates. If you make a purchase from one of our partners this way, the Mac Observer receives a small compensation for sending business their direction. Pretty cool, right? And you don't pay a penny more. This small fee from our affiliates helps us continue to bring you TMO's daily news, reviews, tips, how-tos, and podcasts like this one. So the next time you're thinking about an online purchase, come to TMO's homepage and support the Mac Observer. Thanks. Back to you, John.
And we're back. Thank you, Kelly. Kelly had a history very much like you. I had her on the show in the early time, and she grew up with an Apple II, and she had a teacher who would keep her after class, well, willingly, and they'd mess around and play. And Kelly got to know the Apple II inside and out, and that really launched her career as a young woman technologist.
That's awesome.
Yeah. So now I want to fast forward. I want to ask you about the Wirecutter and how that got started. You are editor in chief. Tell us about all of that.
Sure. So the Wirecutter, you know, just in case anyone doesn't know, we try to help people basically by providing recommendations, you know, in various product categories so that you as the shopper can save time and stress, mostly stress, when it comes to researching what is the best thing to buy. So Wirecutter was originally started by Brian Lamb. You know, previous to Wirecutter, he was the editor-in-chief at Gizmodo. And before that, he had worked at Wired and had a couple other great experiences. But, you know, Brian started the Wirecutter kind of with that goal, which is to help people. You know, he said that he had been, you know, as editor-in-chief of Gizmodo, he had always been that person that his friends and family went to when they were trying to decide what to buy. And he said that he was just constantly getting this, like, flood of requests from people who were just like, hey, man, you know, what is the best TV, you know, best big TV? What's the best laptop? What's the best, you know, even about smaller things, humidifiers, like cables, this and that. And so he kind of started it as a way to just kind of tell people, I put in a handful of hours on research and here's what I found and this is what you should get. You know, in a lot of ways, the growth story of Wirecutter is a lot like the original growth story at ours. You know, he ran it for a while just as a hobby in a way. They didn't have employees. Same with ours back when I first joined. And then it kind of grew to a point where he realized that he wanted to bring in someone to help run it because it was getting big enough. And so that's when he hired me. Brian hired me probably at the very end of 2013. And so it's been a couple years now. And, you know, I've been running the editorial since then. We've grown a lot. It's not just a couple of people providing recommendations on a couple of hours of research. You know, we do a lot of research now on every category that we do. And we do, you know, we do our own testing for most things. And we really try to take both an academic and real world approach to how we look at things and then what we recommend and how we do that. So, you know, now we have a fairly large staff. We're publishing stuff, and we also have the Sweet Home, which is kind of the home side, home, garden, garage, all that stuff. And, people just love, you know, getting recommendations for things that they like hate researching. You know, I think researching things like space heaters sounds like a horrible slog. And I think that's why people
so
come
you're
to
not
us.
Just Apple specific. You do things like, as you said, high definition and 4K TVs.
Oh yeah.
Things like
we do pretty much almost anything that you could think of. And if we don't have it yet, we're probably working on it.
Do you have a laboratory? Do you have one place where you can place all this equipment and put them on a network, or?
We don't have a laboratory. We do have a couple of offices. We have an office in New York and LA and Portland. And so we kind of use those as test spaces for our writers and editors when they do need to go in somewhere and test a bunch of stuff together.
I'm in the market for a 4K TV, but I'm waiting for HDR to get its act together.
Oh, yeah. I'm hearing from our AV people that it does need to get its act together.
Okay, so if you want to buy something at all, whether it's a USB hub or a 4K TV, go to wirecutter.com, and they'll tell you what they've done and what they've tested. Sounds cool.
Thanks. I'm glad glad you like it.
So I want to ask you about some other things. One of the things I've been writing about a lot lately is this Apple versus FBI case.
Mm-hmm.
What are your thoughts on that?
So, you know, I'll admit I may be biased in a certain direction because, again, I did kind of used to cover this stuff. And especially at ours, we are and were very oriented towards privacy. So with that said, I kind of come down on the side of Apple here in that I actually very much appreciate that Apple is going to bat for us users, for us people. In terms of keeping our stuff private, you know, from the government, at least from mass sort of surveillance from the government and being able to get our info. There's obviously a lot of nuances in this particular case. And, you know, Apple's been accused of turning this into a PR thing. And, you know, as someone who covered Apple for practically 10 years, I actually also agree with that. I would say that they are turning it into a PR thing, but that doesn't remove the main goal, which is, in fact, to protect us. So I think that those things can coexist, that that they are, in fact, trying to protect us, and they're also turning it into a, you know, a banner sort of position for them.
The other day on Jeff Gamet's Daily Observations podcast, I mentioned that there are some things that are absolute. You know, we feel like we have an absolute right to be not subject to, say, assault or gunfire. We don't expect to have our car hijacked when we're walking down the street. We don't expect somebody to mug us. And there's no such thing as the government saying, well, you know, this is a nuanced issue. Under some circumstances, you ought to be expecting to be mugged. You know, we have to strike a balance here.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody would agree with that. And so one of the difficult technical issues here is that this relates to a conflict between FBI and their need to collect evidence on this case and make the families happy that they're doing everything they can to see if there's any other elements involved in this terrorism act. But on the other hand, there is this essential, absolute need for millions of iPhone customers to be able to do their banking and to be able to do internet commerce with confidence that their credit cards won't be compromised or their bank accounts, that they can send a message to their parents and say, I'm going to be out of the house for 2 weeks and it won't be intercepted by someone. So in a sense, there's this need for no compromise level of encryption to ensure everybody's security. So I think that's what's making it part of a difficult issue is that this absolutism meets the law enforcement, and how it's going to be resolved, we don't know yet.
Oh, yeah. And certainly it is a very sensitive issue. In a way, it's kind of unfortunate that it had to come up this way, you know, through a terrorist act, because yes, it's emotional, not just for the families of the victims. It's emotional for us, you know, in the United States. But I, you know, obviously I agree. I think that, you know, another reason why I'm sort of biased in this direction is that I have helped a number of people sort of deal with very personal stalker situations where the stalkers are people close to them who have set up a number of technologies to, in fact, get into their phones and track what they're doing and see what they're sending and this and that. And I just, you know, a lot of security researchers, for example, argue that once there is a backdoor for any reason, even if it is a very secure, you know, quote unquote, secure backdoor, it opens things up for hackers of our own, hackers from overseas, et cetera, to get in. And that's the kind of thing that sticks in my mind is because I have personally seen people who are not even good enough to be considered hackers to get information from people's phones that they did, that those people did not realize was being collected. And so that's another way that I kind of think about it is that, you know, people just don't understand fully how technology works. And in a lot of ways, like this is one of those things where, it's not just the government who might be spying on you. In fact, it might be someone very close to you or even someone not very close to you, someone who's trying to find out where you're going to be. And those things are not, you know, backdoors are not immune to people getting in that way.
Right. As soon as they know that there's a backdoor somewhere, they'll apply every expertise they have, even household semi-supercomputers, to try to find those backdoors.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, that's a scary proposition, and we're all following it very closely, and we hope it turns out for the best. I want to turn to something a little more positive and more fun. We've heard rumors that they're pretty solid, that we think Apple's working on an electric car. And I bet you're especially interested in that wire cutter. Maybe
you know,
you'll get to review one of these days.
Yeah, if that is indeed true, then yes, I would love to review that. you know, I guess I feel skeptical about this rumor because, you know, from my perspective, it has been going on forever, since I began writing about Apple, you know, 10 years ago. And so I guess from that perspective, I feel like this is one of these rumors that will never die, and yet it never comes true. But, you know, that said, at the same time, I also really believe in, like, when there's smoke, there's fire. And I think at the moment, there's a little bit of smoke because these rumors are happening more frequently and with more sort of more details here and there.
Look at the people they're hiring.
Yeah. And so I think that, you know, it is possible, and I am interested. I'm kind of an anti-car person myself in my personal life, but I am also very interested in electric, not just electric cars, but also self-driving cars. And I think that ultimately, if this were to happen, Apple will probably be, you know, they'll probably be on top of self-driving technologies, and it will probably be amazing in a lot of ways. So in that sense, I'm very interested.
Yeah, me too. I can't wait. I saw James May on Top Gear the other night, and there was a segment on electric cars. In Norway, 18% of the cars in Norway are electric because Norway promotes it. They have free charging stations. They give big tax breaks, and they make it easy for people to buy electric cars. And they had this little segment where a woman got into a Nissan Leaf and pressed a button. She says, okay, it's on. Silence. No vibration, no noise. Backed out of the driveway, and they were on their way. Another fellow had a Tesla that she was riding with, and he says, oh, I'm never going back. Yeah, it's got 425 horsepower, but they're different kinds of horses.
Oh, yeah. I mean, even now, again, I'm not a huge car person, but certainly Teslas are very interesting to me. I, you know, if I was a billionaire, I would probably own several.
Have you test driven one, maybe?
No, not myself, no. Maybe one day.
Okay. Well, we only have a few minutes left, and I wanted to ask you one more question. Since you're not with ours anymore, you know, steeped in Apple, but you're more at Wirecutter, you're more broad-based, you may feel like maybe you're not, like as you said earlier, not drinking the Apple Kool-Aid. So from that perspective, how are you feeling about Apple from your position now?
Well, you know, for obviously I'm biased because I'm me, but I would like to believe that I, even when I was covering it, I was pretty sober. That was actually one of my bragging points, was that I was doing sober coverage of Apple. You know, that said, I do have a little bit more distance now than I did before. You know, I guess I will always be someone who loves their products. I do think that even if quality changes, they're still probably going to be, you know, steps ahead of a lot of other competitors. So in that sense, I will always be one of those people. But I do, you know, I do feel as if there are a lot of ways in which quality is not so good. And it's not so much the quality, because I think that often they fix issues that come up. But I also think that it seems from the outside like they care less about mass quality issues. You know, in the past, there might have been some issues with various computers and that they would address right away, or even, you know, with the iPhone screen, like changing iPhone screens to Gorilla Glass at the last second before releasing the first iPhone. Like, things like that used to happen, and they may still happen. But to me, it feels like there's a lot more, you know, we have a very general audience at Wirecutter, so I hear about these things a lot more. And it feels like a lot of this general audience is struggling a lot with their Apple products in ways that we didn't used to, you know, back in the day, or even 10 years ago, we didn't used to struggle as much as people struggle now. And I think that, you know, Apple used to pride itself, and probably still does pride itself, as being kind of a technology company for the people. You know, they really try to consider real world use and how people use things very deeply. But at the same time, it really feels kind of disconnected. So, you know, I don't claim to know what's happening on the inside, but I just hope that they're listening. I hope that Apple is paying attention to what people are saying on the internet and what kinds of problems people have when they go into the store. And I hope that they are taking those things seriously. You know, I went into the Apple store just a few weeks ago for some of my own phone issues, and I felt very condescended to from the Apple genius, who was a woman. So, you know, I can't take that into consideration, but I just felt like she was really talking past me about the issues and not listening to the real situation that I was experiencing.
Did you write about that?
I didn't write about it. Maybe I should. But I think that that's an experience that a lot of people are having lately, and that's kind of sad.
Mm. You know, I'm getting that feedback too. So I don't know where it's going to go. Apple's no doubt going to get bigger and more ambitious. And so it is kind of concerning to all of us. Well, yeah. This has been fascinating. I wish we could go on, but guess what? We are out of time.
Oh, so sad.
It always happens. So I want to thank you so much for being on the show. This has been a fascinating discussion. Tell the listeners how to contact you.
Well, you can find me on Twitter at ejackie, E-J-A-C-Q-U-I, or at The Wirecutter, jackie@thewirecutter.com.
Excellent, excellent. Listeners, I hope you enjoyed the show, and thank you for coming by. We'll see you again next time on the Mac Observer's Background Mode.